Okay, why don't we get started? I know people are still coming in. Has Paul got to drive the bus up? So waiting for him is going to be too long, isn't it? Is he driving it all the way up? Does he have to drive it up? What? Well, I could just, you know, patter for 5 minutes. I'll do a little of that. My name is John Wallace. How many of you were not here yesterday?
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Roughly the title of what I'm talking about this week is How Societies Work. It's a very small, tidy, neat little problem. I'm an economist at the University of Maryland. And I've been working on kind of problems. I mostly do American history, American economic history. And in fact, if I knew Mel was going to be here, Mel Thiel was going to be here, I might have just done early 19th century America, which is fascinating. I've been working on ideas about how societies fit together. And just in a way, brief review, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, there are three cold hard facts that I want us to come to grips with about how societies work and kind of basic information. One is that until about 10,000 years ago, what we would call the Neolithic Revolution, that the largest groups of human population that we have any evidence for were maybe 100 or 200, and that at the average, the typical group was 30 people. Okay, and then about 200 years ago, in what we typically call the Industrial Revolution, even though modern developed economies and societies are no longer very industrial, they're service-oriented. There was a dramatic change in both the rate of economic growth, what we might call economic development, but that was matched with political development, it was matched with social developments, that was matched with religious development, in terms of freedom of choice, and that sort of thing. So that there's a process of development. Dave, are you here? Dave Reiki, Brower Reiki is not here. Talk today about the hockey stick graph, that there's a dramatic increase in lots of things that happens about 200 years ago. And this is the third cold hard fact, but it doesn't seem important at the moment, hopefully it may not, is that these things have all happened too recently in the past for them to be explained by any significant genetic change in people. Okay? It's really going to be, I don't know, it may turn out to be trivial, but I think it might really be important. Yesterday, I talked about emotions and rationality. This may seem a little stupid since I'm an economist, and economists assume that people are rational. But it turns out not all economists do that anymore, and actually all economists do assume that people are rational. The economists are just trying to figure out a little bit better how people work, how people actually make decisions and how their minds work. And I'm going to talk today about a book that I really like called Predictably Irrational. The author is Dan Ariely, A-R-I-E-L-Y. I don't think he's an economist, but he might be. He's at MIT. What does it say he is? Oh, yeah. He's the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Behavioral Economics at MIT. Well, I guess he is an economist. Maybe he is. Anyway, I'm going to talk about this today. And this is about sort of how economists beginning to understand how people make decisions. It's not just economics. It turns out that there's psychology is involved in this. There's a field, a growing field, called neuroeconomics. I'm going to talk about an example out of this book, where cognitive scientists are actually trying to figure out how the brain actually makes decisions, how we make decisions. I hope it'll become clear over the next few days about why I'm focusing on individuals. If we want to have a theory of the society, the first thing we have to start with is a theory about how individuals behave. And economists tend to frame behavior in terms of choice. Dorothy and I were having a discussion about choice. You know, the popular culture is, do you choose Coke or Pepsi? You know, that's your range of choice. But there's the big choices, like, are you a Lutheran or a Catholic? Do you believe or not believe? Are you willing to shut up and listen? Big choice.
Could you go ask my 8-year-old that? That's why I'm late.
That's why you're late. And until we have a theory of understanding about how individuals behave, then we can't understand how groups function. And that, so we need to get to groups here, and that's kind of where I'm going to try to go today. And until we understand how groups form, then we can't understand how larger societies form. And about 10,000 years ago, when we begin to observe larger societies, what we're observing is groups of groups. right? And so that's kind of where we're going. And yesterday I talked about a book by Antonio Damasio called The Feeling of What Happens. And I've learned, newsflash, it's in the bookstore for $15.99. Damasio talks about how people make decisions, and he talks about the emotional context for rationality. That is, that our emotions, physically, the way we're wired, leads us to have feelings which are connected to our bodies, that our mind is from its very beginning of an organism, you know, like squirrels or chipmunks. Brains have to be connected with the body in order to regulate bodily functions, and so the brain has to feel what the body is doing. And those are feelings. In humans, those get actually converted into emotions, and we all know, okay, so look, I was crying last night when I was giving Vespers because my father-in-law and my grandmother, you know, who was the head of housekeeping here for 25 years, and my sons were there, you know, so I get all, I mean, I'm doing it again. You know, it isn't just that I'm emotional. I just had shivers up and down my spine. And if you were close to me, you'd see that the hair is standing up on my arms, right? And all of you can see those signs and know that something's happening to me, right? Because we all read each other's emotions. Right? We are endowed by our genetic heritage with an ability to do that. And that's going to turn out to be incredibly important for relationships. So what I want to talk today about is incomplete relationships. Why, when we deal with one another, particularly in larger groups, we can't just depend upon our personal ability to sense what's going on with one another. Even though that's an incredibly powerful human ability to do that. Yesterday, after the session, several people had comments and questions that were very useful and important. Ricky Jampar talked to me about one time when she was driving to North Dakota and looked on the speedometer and she was going 115 miles an hour. We talked about speed limits yesterday. And a friend of mine who pointed out the spot to me that he got his only speeding ticket in his entire life. And my response to him was, you don't drive fast enough. Now, everybody should have at least a dozen by the time they're 50. Okay, but in fact, what happened, you know, when you drive, it's really complicated, right? And there's all this information coming in. It's not just you driving your car. You have to pay attention to everybody else. Do you do anything more trusting than driving on the interstate? You are with all these people who you do not know, who you have good evidence are not trustworthy, that are hurtling along in Chevy Suburbans like mine that weigh 3,000 pounds and can crush you in an instant. And yet, we just drive. Right? That's really complicated. And if we thought about what we were doing, we would stop dead still. So that there's this incredibly complex environment going on around us that we have to learn to feel our way through. Okay? So that this connection between rationality and feeling and emotions is one that our body uses. It uses it all the time. In fact, it's not just our body, it's our mind. Our mind, our process of rationality uses emotions and feelings to structure our responses to the complex world around us. So very often we respond to situations that are too complex to rationally figure out by feeling, by intuition. In my field, great economists are said to have very good intuition. You describe a problem to them, and then bingo, they have the answer. And then you give them 2 weeks, and they can write it all down, and they can figure out all the logic behind it. But they have this intuition. They see the problem. And you know what? They feel that they have the right answer. In my house, it's called clear channel. So when I get an idea, I just got it. I did get an idea, and I get shivers up and down my spine. I just go, woo! Okay, now I don't know why that happens. I have no control over it. And if I had control over it, it wouldn't work. Right? I couldn't have a stupid idea. Oh, let's shiver. You know? That wouldn't happen. So that somehow this process of emotion and rationality is deeply connected. And that's the point of Damasio's book. And I really encourage those of you who are interested to read it. It's beautifully written. It's, you know, you got to think about it, but it's a very accessible book. Paul Hinderly talked to me last night, and this gets to what Mal was talking about with Luther and the Catholic Church. That Luther, we're going to talk about organizations. In fact, this whole thing is about how do you organize society, right? That Luther, you know, Luther was a Catholic. And many of Luther's complaints about the Catholic Church were not about the doctrine of the church, they were about the organization of the church. Of course, actually, after the church tried to kill him, you know, swore out a death warrant, you're a heretic, that kind of stuff, he actually started changing some beliefs too. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make it like, you know, we're all just Catholics and they changed. Mel can straighten us out on that. But there is some things there that are important. Some stuff that David Brower-Rieke was talking about yesterday, I'm really going to come back. This is all going to be about trust. Okay, how do people trust each other? Because if you're going to be involved with people, you got to trust them. And the entire human sexuality statement that the ELCA is going to vote on is called trust and faith. Faith and trust?
Trust and gift.
Trust and gift, right. The trust is a huge word. Okay, how do we do that? And as you'll see, this is all about this. The last point that I want to bring up, that this came up in 1 Kings 19, that Patricia was talking about, and also that was a subtext for David yesterday in human sexuality, and if you came to Genesis, was his entire political framing. Violence is really important. Elijah is scared and running for the hills because the king is and the queen has just said, hey, you're dead. I promise you you're dead. I just didn't swear it out. I'm going to send my little bird to tell in your ear, you're toast, buddy. I'm out of here. Okay, now violence is a really important part of human behavior. All those bad things, rape, murder. They, you know what? They all happen. They're all real. And when you get close to them, okay, how do we structure society for people to trust one another? How do we deal with the possibility of that people may be violent? I'm going to talk mostly about that tomorrow, but it's come up in the discussion this week. When we think about ordering social relationships, we have to deal with the problem of violence. You just cannot assume it away because it will bite you in the ass. Okay. Oh, yeah, we'll invade Iraq and they'll love us. Shoot, they want to kill us. Right? Well, that turned out to be a big, you know, like, I don't know, $200 billion problem for us. Several thousand of our lives, I mean, tens of thousands of their lives, to get rid of this violence problem, because until they got the violence problem under control, nothing else was going to work. Okay, so we need to be able eventually to get back to that. So those are some of the places that we're going here. Emotions. Anybody have any questions? Wasn't here yesterday. Like, who is this guy? I don't get any calmer, by the way. I wish Ron Vignier was here. The first year I was here, Ron Vignier was a pastor, and he was doing Bible study. And I looked really calm and organized in comparison to Ron. But he doesn't come, you know, so I look a little bit scattered. Okay, so emotions frame decisions. What do we mean by that? It means that, that when we are making a decision about something, our emotion... We have to perceive the problem. We have to perceive the alternatives over which we're making choices. And our emotional state really affects that. Okay? And so what I want to do is talk a little bit about the brain. And don't believe anything specifically that I'm about to say. Okay, but the general point's okay. Because I'm not a cognitive science, I'm not a brain specialist, and I can give you some things to read if you want that are interesting. But there is, and there's lots of ideas out there about how the brain works, which are daily being refuted. So even if I was to say, this is the truth, read from the current authority, next week it might be wrong. But three brains. Not three heads, three brains. We have the reptile brain. You've heard it said this. We have... This is the part of the brain that is in charge. It's the oldest part of the brain, perhaps. That's in dispute. In evolutionary terms, this is the part of the brain that deals with things automatically. It's the homeostatic part, the autonomic nerve system. The vagus nerve that goes to your stomach and your lungs, that regulates digestion and breathing and that sort of thing. Stuff here happens pretty much automatically. Then, there's another brain. And some people call it the limbic system, or the midbrain. The limbic system is evolutionarily, now there's a big debate about whether this comes after the reptile brain or not, and exactly what's in here. I have a great book, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, called The General Theory of Love, which has anybody read it? Did you like it?
Yes, but I don't remember much about it.
Okay, so, yeah. There's the problem with this part of the brain, you know. The memory part. Oh, yeah, I read that. You know, the worst thing for me is when I open up a book that I've never read before and my handwriting is in it. Oh, man, am I getting old. Okay, so the limbic brain in The General Theory of Love, which is the guy's name is Thomas Lewis, is the base. There's three authors, but he's the main author. It's about our ability to sense emotions in others. And the limbic system is really related to this. Mammals have well-developed limbic systems. Reptiles don't. Okay, so when you come home and your snake is in comes up, slithers up to greet you, you really can't tell whether the snake is happy or sad. Right? But when the dog comes up to you, you know right away what is happening. And your dog will sense your emotions. The cat will sense your emotions and go, I don't care. Right? But all mammals have limbic systems. Why do all mammals have limbic systems? Evolutionarily, animals are carried inside their mothers. They're not laid in eggs. They're not external. And as a result, mammals, when they're born, are helpless. The General Theory of Love is about psychiatry. As I said, I'm going to come back and talk about it in a minute, that there's a very strong bond between mothers and children. There actually is a very strong bond between parents and children. And we are genetically programmed, when we're little tiny babies, we do three things, right? We eat, we sleep, and we poop. But what's the thing we really do? We smile at our mom and our dad because we don't want them to leave us. Because if they do, we're dead. Okay? So there's very strong connections in a part of the brain that is able to recognize emotions and interpret emotions in other people. In the General Theory of Love, this is almost like magic. Like, you close your eyes. And in some of the stuff between mothers and infants is really, really powerful about the ability of communication between mothers and infants. I'm not going to go into the details. I could do a whole week on it. It's really fun. Then there's the neocortex. And this is the part of the brain that's really well developed in humans. It's much smaller than the other primates, and it's very small in most other mammals. And this is the part of the brain that is in some sense rational, although, you know, functions are scattered all over. The brain is not, when you get it. You know, when you go to the store to buy your brain, it's just a blank slate. That's a book by Steven Pinker, who is an evolutionary psychologist. He's a neuroscientist, but he writes about what's called evolutionary psychology. How does the brain work? Actually, that's an interesting book, How Does the Brain Work, by Steven Pinker, P-I-N-K-E-R, about sort of evolutionary psychology, that third thing, about how did the brain get to be the way it is? Why does it function the way it is? That's fascinating. That the neocortex has lots of places that do rational things. So if you give somebody a math problem and you put them in a functional magnetic resonance imaging system that looks at activity within the brain, this part will light up. Okay. If you stick somebody in the butt with a needle, this part will light up. And then this part will light up. So you can see what parts of the brain are going, and that's where this neuroeconomics comes in. Actually putting people in situations where we can see what their brain is doing and then testing them. Beep, beep, beep. Okay. How do they make decisions? We'll come to a Coke and Pepsi thing in a minute. Now, what's really interesting is this framing problem, okay, that the kinds of decisions we make depend upon the way things are framed. So there's these games, you know, experiments. People are doing experiments on other people now. They hire college students and they put them in. They do a bargaining game, you know, where you've got $10 and you've got to decide how you're going to split it up, right? So Marcia and Phil are playing the game, and I give the $10 to Marcia, and Marcia has to make an offer to Phil. And then Phil can accept it or not. And if Phil doesn't accept it, they get nothing. So how much does Marcia offer Phil?
Not enough. Not enough.
Okay. Well, it turns out that if when Marcia comes in and Phil comes in, if I give them a piece of candy, they're more likely to agree, and they're more likely to get close to 50-50. Okay? Whereas I read a selection from Mein Kampf to Marcia, right, and I stick a pin in Phil, they're much more likely not to agree. It has nothing to do with the rationality of their decision. What's the default rule? 50-50. Right? And if you don't get 50-50, people get pissed. Right? If Marcia continues to offer $2.50, Phil eventually says, I'm not playing this game anymore, I'm not going to cooperate with you. Okay. Now, rationally, Phil should always cooperate, because and if Marcia was an economist, how much should you offer Phil?
1 cent.
1 cent, and Phil should say yes. But games don't work that way. People are not necessarily rational. Okay. But we can affect Marcia's behavior by framing the problem in different kinds of ways. A lot of these cheating games, if you read the Ten Commandments, people cheat less. How does that work? What's going on? You know, what's happening? Well, there is some neuroscience to this. That there's a guy named Joseph Ledoux. He's a neuroscientist, and he has a book called The Emotional Brain. I'm not going to recommend you read it because it's pretty heavy going. I mean, read it if you want, but you might want to save it for a little bit. And so what Ledoux does, and I want to kind of redo this graph a little bit. I have the reptile brain and the limbic brain just connected here and here, and the neocortex. And of course, all these things are connected in our brain. That Ledoux was interested in emotional responses. And so here's this kind of classic case. You're walking down that old Heart Lake Trail. We used to have a song about that. I have often walked down the Heart Lake Trail. Did you know that?
Yeah. You sang it.
But I'm...
You did?
Ah!
Philip Renault was here.
Oh, yeah. But I never found a place where there was food for sale. Okay, so you see a stick! And what do? Right? Now, why do you do that?
Looks like a snake.
It might be a snake. Okay. Now, when you do that, it isn't just that you go, oh, geez, there's something there that might be dangerous. Maybe I should respond. Right? Your hair sticks up. You need to get tense. Your body goes, adrenaline. Right? All those things are being done here in a way that you have absolutely no control over. My younger son, until the time that I almost killed him, you know, we would get him dressed for, you know, we'd be getting ready to go to nursery school. And Dan would go hide somewhere in the house. And when I walked in, he would jump out and scare me. And I have a really bad fright reflex. And my first response was to throttle the guy, you know, because I just get really, I have a really bad surprise reflex. And I have no control over it. Even though I got to, he's around here somewhere. Okay, it's going to happen. Well, finally I said, Dan, don't do that anymore. Just, you know, we're going to have a murder on our hands or a serious injury, and I'm going to go to jail. You know, for child abuse, I'm sorry, I can't control it. Just like driving a car. It's too complex. If you start thinking about it, it doesn't work because the thinking part of your brain is up here. Right? So you get this, you see the snake, and actually that input from your eyeball goes here and here. And it's this loop that actually says to your body, you got to react right now. And then you say, wait a minute, is that a stick or a snake? Now, evolutionary, in terms of evolution, one can see why that makes sense. Because people who said, is that a snake or not, might not make it. Darwin's law would apply. So what Ledoux did is, it's kind of gruesome, he took rats and he put them on a plate and he shocked them, you know, when the lights went off or the sound went off or the whatever. And then, okay, I don't advocate this. He started taking out parts of their brain, okay, to see how they would respond and where the fear response would come from. And it turns out that you can get rid of all the neocortex part of a rat brain, and you'll get the response. If you take out the limbic part, or this is the hippocampus and amygdala. I'm not going to say the words anymore because I'll get them wrong, and they won't mean anything anyway. If you take out the red part, and you leave in the black part, so the neural wires, it doesn't work. They don't get the right fear response. They get the response, but they don't react right. That is, they need the and this is an emotional response. This part, if you take the neocortex out, you get the physical symptoms. You get the adrenaline shock, you get that. Without that, oh, where do I go? You know, what should I do next? Kind of thing. And so the automatic response, which is an unconscious response, there's strong evolutionary reasons for believing that that happens. And what's that happens, that's really clever. There's strong evolutionary reasons for believing that that wiring scheme has important benefits for people, has important benefits for organisms, that has important benefits for mammals in general. But what means is that when this part of the brain, it sees a stick, it activates the automatic systems. And you can actually see in these MRIs that that reaction happens before the brain starts thinking about snake or stick. The signal goes there at the same time, but there's actually a sequencing. Now, go back to the speeding thing, or whatever, which is not so much time dependent, although decisions when you're driving a car can be incurred incredibly rapidly. We in fact, work and function in a way that our emotional system does frame the rational decisions that the brain has to make. So in the early book, there's a couple of really interesting things, but I'm gonna skip. I could talk about it all day, so I'm not going to. I'm going to talk about Coke or Pepsi. So, you know, remember the television ads where there was Coke or Pepsi and people, and you know, Coke did it and Coke won, Pepsi did it and Pepsi won. You know, well, how could that be? Well, they're fudging the numbers, you know. Because everybody has, of course, there's this problem about values and treasure, right? But it also turns out that if we're not having an eyeball here. You put people in an MRI machine, and you see that's where the things they slide in on, right? So they can't go. You can't go in and give them a can of something, but you give them a long straw, and then they got a video screen over their head, and you give them a drink, okay, of a cola. So there's a long straw in the can, and when they take a sip, this part of the brain lights up. Okay. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's Coke or Pepsi or Giant or Safeway or Albertsons or cheap as anything dirt or snack bar cola. What do we have in the snack bar? Who knows? Okay. This part lights up. If you flash Coke or Pepsi on the screen, this part lights up. And then the signal goes down here. And it turns out this is activated in the parts where memory is important. If you tell people, do you like it or not, they don't care about Coke or Pepsi very much. But it turns out that if you tell them what's going on, the Coke part will light up and their decision about the taste will be biased in favor of Coke. Coke's done a better job at brand recognition, at getting this. Now, what does this mean? Remember yesterday when I talked about my thumb and cutting my thumb off? Those of you who weren't here, I'll reveal this gruesome story. I was cutting onions when I was making spaghetti with my kids, and I cut the end of my thumb almost completely off. I had to run to the hospital to have 8 or 9 stitches put in. And then, of course, the next time I picked up a knife, woo, boy, did I feel that one. Now, I knew intellectually, neocortex-wise, that, you know, that was an accident. Be careful. Don't stick your thumb under the knife. You know, I was a cook at Holden Village, so this is, you know, I've cut myself plenty of times. And so I was very careful when I did the onion. But my body said, okay, idiot, I remember what happened, and we're activating all the automatic systems so that you pay attention this time. I have no control over that. I don't light up anymore when I pick up a knife, but for about a year I did. I had absolutely no control over it. It was a very strong emotional response that I had learned. Okay. Now, the general theory of love argument is about the limbic system and our ability to perceive emotions in other people. A bunch of those things happen here. Our ability to read each other's emotions, our ability to sense things. You know, you can line up 200 pictures of 200 faces, and almost all of us in the room will be able to distinguish all 200 of them. We might even be able to remember some of them. What happens if we line up 200 watermelon? They're just green things. They're just as different as faces, but we don't recognize them, right? Because we're not wired to see, ah. You smile at people, they smile back. It doesn't matter what culture you're in the world. You give people pictures of people who are happy and people who are angry, and they can tell. There are some cultural tics, but they're very small compared to our ability to read emotions in other people. And this stuff happens at the framing level, not the rationality level. It's not that I see Steffi looking perplexed and go, oh, crap, this is not going very well. Right? I don't rationalize it. I look at her, I can immediately tell, woo, bing, bang, some of your, you know, what you're doing. Of course, you're all fascinated. we do this all the time, right? Does it matter to us? Does it shape how we behave? Yes. Okay. Our rationality and how we deal with other people is constantly being adjusted by our perceptions of what situation we think we're in. And that's extremely, extremely powerful. Do you know anybody whose emotions you can't read? You know people whose emotions you have trouble reading?
Yeah, Alzheimer's.
Right? What?
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's, clearly. But I mean, okay, so we were talking about pathologies. That is important, but I don't want to go to pathology quite. Even in normalness, well, there's a huge range of normalness. I mean, there are Alzheimer's, autism, things like that are many, many mental illnesses that are connected to defects in this particular part of the brain. And lots of mental illness is related to inability to deal with other people appropriately or interpret signals. But some of us, all of us, turns out, have some troubles here. I've learned one thing about myself. Sometimes when people get hurt, I laugh. I have no idea why. It's not a good response. It really pisses people off. Oh, okay. I have no control over it. I mean, I'm working on it, like shut up. Shut up's a big word in my head. You don't know all the things I might have said. We know people who have persistent responses. We all know people. I know lots of people who I just can't imagine that every day they're taking out a shotgun and shooting their foot off. Because of the way they behave and the way they act. You guys know anybody like that? I have some dear friends who I just can't believe that they continue to behave the way they behave, even though they're dear and wonderful people. They react to situations in ways that they apparently can't control. Do you ever influence somebody by the tone of your voice?
Yeah.
Parents, children, husbands, wives? You know how hard that is to control? Really hard. Right? Why? Because you react in the framing, the emotional frame of what's happening. You don't sit, now, when you do that, you sit there and go, okay, I'm not going to talk until I figured out what the tone of my voice should be. Which kind of impedes the flow of conversation. And then you say, oh dear, you know, I really don't want to piss you off. So I'm going to say this really nicely. You know, that doesn't work. Right? That's not an effective conversational gambit. How do we get around this? And in fact, much of our rational behavior then is conditioned by our immediate responses. And importantly, some of our immediate responses are genetic, but many of them are learned. And the point about the limbic system is, and this the whole point of the general theory of love book, is how do we learn to react emotionally to other people? Who teaches us? Our experience. So it's mostly parents, siblings, and people that we interact with. So the General Theory of Love book is in its penultimate chapter. It's written by psychiatrists, and it's for the practice of psychiatry, which says that if you have somebody who's grown up with people who are damaged in some way, so they've learned a pattern of emotional response that is causing them difficulties, that the way the psychiatrist can deal with that person is not by going in and saying, you know, let's bring up this deep image from your consciousness about your mother and father sleeping together. It's to pattern a healthy emotional response. And that's not about consciousness, it's about this part. It's about how do you actually respond. Now, I don't know anything about psychiatry to know whether that's good or not. But I sure know. As you know, I have two sons here, one's 21 and 23, and I am seeing a lot of my bad habits in the flesh. Okay? I mean, I see my feet when I look at my younger son's feet. You know, and I see my blowhardedness when I hear my older son boast. Okay? I see lots of me in them because I'm one of the people on whom this learning process about how the system works is based. Questions? Comments?
I don't know if there's a question or not, but...
Would you like to make a statement?
Yeah, I guess.
Please state your name for the court.
So you have a child who is clearly having an emotional reaction. And the parents say, what's wrong?
Yeah.
Or the rational response... It's clearly at odds
right.
with what is going on
yeah.
emotionally.
Right.
I suppose I'm asking what's a parent to do?
Okay. We don't know what a parent should do in any kind of sense. And in fact, part of this kind of stuff I don't think we have any answers about what a parent is to do in any kind of abstract, general kind of way. I think one of the really exciting parts of this stuff about the neuroscience and the cognitive behavior is that we are learning more, a lot more, really fast about these kinds of things and how they work. Do you know parents that deal effectively with their children when they're upset, as opposed to parents that deal ineffectively? I sure know them. Okay. I wish I could say I always dealt effectively. I didn't. Okay. I'm not trying to say that I don't have an answer to how you do that. What I have is that we're wired that way. And one of the reasons that this happens, it can be so much of a problem, is that when the child cries or gets upset, what does that do to us, the parent? It creates an emotion, right? It triggers something up here. You ever get, you know that when your child is upset, getting mad at them is unlikely to make it worse, but what happens? You get upset. And it doesn't matter whether you say anything, because your kid does not have to hear words out of your mouth to know that you're upset. They see it. You are the most important person in their life. They've been watching you for their entire life. And they know every single little thing about you. You know, you tick like this when you're mad or whatever. They know it. You know, so just the words out of your mouth are not the only thing. And you can't control that. You can't, actually. You can try to learn, and you can try to teach yourself. That's Spinoza, right? That we can try to model how we behave and how we react and practice that. Because, in fact, this is not a genetically fixed response. This is something that we learn. But, boy, I don't know. Dorothy?
I'm a little puzzled that yesterday you were trying to convince us that we have choice of all different
yes.
kinds.
Yeah.
And today you're trying to persuade us that we're conditioned
yeah.
in these really fun
to drop the black and white stuff. I'm sorry. And no, no. In fact, I think I'm sorry. I overreacted.
Anybody else notice this?
No. Actually, that's okay.
I think it's a bold.
So you know what President Truman said about economists? He wants a one-handed one. Because he wants an economist that won't say, on the other hand. Okay? Now, there is no doubt that we have choice. Right? Do you have choice when you deal with your kids?
Yes.
Okay. Are we conditioned? Yeah. Do we have responses? Yeah. The predictable, irrational stuff is, there are way of framing choices so that you see the problem, and almost all the stuff is about framing. Yeah. The choice, how you put the decision to be made, even if it's exactly the same logical, rational problem, framing it makes a difference. So, and that can be manipulated by advertising agencies, by pastors, by speakers, rhetoricians of all types. So life is a combination of those things. Okay, we do have choice. We do have conditions. We are conditioned. We do condition ourselves. We are conditioned by the world in which we live. Okay, and so we don't. I'm affirming those two very contradictory things, and saying we need to encompass those because people are not rationally simple from the inside or the outside.
Yeah. I don't know where to go with this, but towards the end, before you open up the questions,
I'm open up to questions from.
But just before, just the last couple of minutes.
Oh, before I was so rude and interrupted.
Excuse me, am I trying to frame your
No.
What you talked about started to cause in the back of my head the statement of Paul in Romans 7. The good that I want to do, I do not. And the evil that I don't want to do is what I end up doing.
Yes. Yeah, there's incredibly interesting stuff in here about procrastination, about decisions, about things that we say we want to do and don't do. Okay, so here's what I was going to do in Vespers last night, and I skipped. How many of you, we were talking in today in Genesis, how many of you, we have a material society, we have a society of stuff, as Patricia would say, right? How many of you think you have too much stuff?
Oh.
Why don't you get rid of it?
Oh, my
goodness.
Took a lot of effort to get it.
Okay, now here's what an economist would say. I don't care what you say, I don't care what you do. And I don't care if you tell me you got too much stuff and just went out and bought a new car. I'm just not believing what you say. In fact, economists are so good at that they just don't listen to what people say. They just try to look at what they do. Now, I have too much stuff. I eat too much. I drink too much. I talk too much. Those are all things that I have issues with, none of which I've been able to solve. Right? Irrationally, this part of me says, you know, you'd be better if you lost 20 pounds. And this part of me says, that steak's really good. Okay? Now, I could work on trying to shape my habits, and believe me, my wife, Ellen, bless her soul, is trying to work on me. Guess what? When she tries to get me to eat less, it pisses me off, I eat more. Okay? I mean, you know, there's crazy dynamics, right? I'm not saying I'm rational. I'm trying to be. There's some really interesting things about the kinds of, I talked about the financial crisis this morning. How many saved enough for retirement? Nobody. Okay. Yeah. Right. You know about why we all know we ought to save more. Why don't we do it? Right. And it turns out there's ways to structure your life so you will save more. There's ways to structure your life so that you'll eat less. There's ways to structure your life so you'll smoke less. Will it always work for you? No. Okay. So those are really, really powerful things. That is, there's promises that we make to ourselves that we consistently break. It does not mean we're not rational about them. It just means we can't quite do them. Because consciousness, rationality, does not inform all of the decisions that we make. I want to eat less, but when I get to that meal, it isn't that I've forgotten that I want to eat less. I say, you know what? I'm a rational maximizer, and this food is worth more to me now than the less weight in the future. You can still be perfectly rational. The problem is, how do you implement the problem? Okay? That's where rationality gets caught up in values, right? Emotions, the things that condition our decisions, which are coming out of this process as well as out of the rationality process.
Are there any predictions on how fast and how long it will take for the neocortex to gather enough strength to gather enough?
I'm not an expert on this, but you can read some of these guys, and they actually do talk about how it is possible. One of the books I like is called Nudge, and it's how you can frame. It's all about context. So how you can change your life to change the context of your decisions. I know this sounds funny. If you want to have this stuff, buy a Prius. Buy a smaller house. Okay. You don't have to get less stuff in all one fell swoop, but start somewhere and set your expectations lower, set your behavior different, and all of a sudden, less will look like more. Because your brain turns out frames things in relative terms. You do that. I want to go somewhere with this. I'm willing to talk about it, but I also have some other place I want to get to. Okay. So questions? Yeah.
The Bible talks a lot about the influence of God and the influence of Satan.
Huh?
Does that frame paradigm include any of that?
It might, of course. Some of us think that this is God part, this is the Satan part. Some of us think that this is the Satan part and this is the God part, right? Well, the devil made me eat that hot fudge sundae. You know, God put me on the Atkins diet, or vice versa. You may have gotten the idea that I'm not just a simple economist. Okay, I don't believe that people just maximize X. I think all these things really do matter. Does it matter to people that we say, here's a great example. I graduated from college in 1970. I went to Pacific Lutheran University for my freshman year, and we had men's and women's dorms. There were people, parents of people in this room, maybe, who said to me, if you have premarital sex, you will die, you know, or something like that. You remember? Remember what the world was like before effective birth control? And when was the last time you heard a discussion in church about premarital sex? Okay, it might be, I don't know, David's here, but it's in the sexuality discussion. Because the world has changed. Now, clearly, the issue about God and Satan, that was a really important element in that discussion. That in some sense has now evaporated. Not completely, but I do talk to my sons about sex, but not in the way that my father talked to me. So those things are clearly, how we motivate people, are really important. And I think do have to do with this.
I know just this much about neuroscience, but there is something about mental maps.
Oh yeah, that's
so that if we keep doing something mm-hmm. one way, and we want to change our behavior by asking ourselves, going back to that mental map of, oh, I want to change my behavior, we're just reinforcing that particular map rather than looking at a new way, a new solution versus going back and trying, for example, to lose weight the same way you always have done before. Yeah.
In fact, DeBosco talks about mental maps in the book. Okay, I want to, this is obviously fascinating, right? I mean, we could talk about this all week, about how to think about what, and the experiments are really neat, because they're like candy bars at Halloween and stuff like that, the people that are doing this are very clever in the way they thought about testing their ideas about how to do these things. I want to talk now about trust and cooperation, because I want to go back to the groups of 30 part. And there's a very famous problem in what's called game theory. It's a branch of economics that's shared with other disciplines. It's called the prisoner dilemma. Okay. And so we got Rich and Marcia. that have, unfortunately, they're drug lords. And they've been arrested for being in possession of 100 pounds of cocaine. And I'm the prosecutor, and I put them in different cells. And I go up to him and say, Marcia, I know that you both did it, but if you squeal on Rich, he's going to go to jail for 10 years, and I'll only give you a year. And I go to Rich and I say, I'm giving the same deal. Okay. If you're willing to turn Marcia in, I'll give you a year's jail term. Otherwise, you're getting, you know, if she squeals it, she'll get 10, you'll get one. If neither one of you squeal, you both get 1 year. But if you turn the other one in, you let go. You get let go. Okay, so that's the deal. So we could actually. I'm not going to draw the table. So, John Nash, the Beautiful Mind guy, movie, came up with what's called a Nash equilibrium as a way to solve, to see whether there's a solution to this problem. And so, what John in the movie, they're in a bar and they're trying to figure out how to pick up girls. These are a bunch of mathematics graduate students, so they couldn't pick up. and so Nash starts writing down the piece of paper. Well, here's the way the Nash equilibrium works, the Nash theory. Marcia says, okay, what if Rich squeals or what if Rich stays quiet? What's my best response? If it turns out her best response to both activities is whether Rich cooperates or not, whether he is quiet or not, is for her to squeal, then she squeals. And Rich looks... He has the same thing. Okay, Marcia is quiet. What's my best option? If she squeals, what's my best option? And in the game I just laid out, for both of them, the best option is to rat out the other one. That's why it's called the prisoner's dilemma, because they can't communicate with one another. They're in separate cells. And even though they would collectively be better off if they both just went to jail for 1 year, they would serve 2 years jail time. Each one of them would prefer the other go to jail for 10 years and they get out free. So, there's a problem with cooperation there. This is a problem of trust. How do they know to trust each other? If we play this game only once, John Nash tells us that both of them will squeal, and in fact, they'll squeal fast, because they'll realize that if they don't squeal first, they go to jail for 10 years. Prisoner's dilemma. Now, when we think about cooperation and trust, in a world where we don't know people, we have to solve this problem, because cooperation always, trust always puts us in a vulnerable position, where we're potentially damaged more if the person that we're trusting betrays that trust. Prisoner's dilemma. If I lend people money and they don't pay back, I'm worse off than if I never lend them the money. Prisoner's dilemma. Now, what's the solution to that?
Contract.
Well, contract. You could try to write something ex ante, and then you could go to the judge and say, look, Lord, Judge, Your Honor, I know that we both had the cocaine, but we promised that she would go to jail. Okay, who's going to honor the contract? But I think, what happens if they're hardened criminals, which they are, of course, they, nobody with 100 pounds of cocaine wouldn't be. What if this happens all the time? What if the game is repeated? Instead of being one shot,
they quit talking. They don't squeal.
They don't squeal. So crime members, when they get made into a crime family, promise not to squeal. Okay. Now we have a contract thing, because if a crime member squeals when they get out, what happens to them? They die.
Yes.
But somebody else has to enforce that law because the other guy's in jail. Now, repeated interaction. Forget about the third party for the moment. Repeated interaction can make the prisoner's dilemma game problem go away. That is, if we deal with people persistently so that they know every time they get in jail, they're better off, each of them serving a year, than one of them serving 10 at some point down the line. They both have a strong incentive not to turn the other in until Rich gets cancer. At which point he squeals. Oh, but then Marcia thinks, wait a minute, maybe he's going to get cancer. Maybe, okay. So repeated interaction can solve the problem of coordination and trust. And this is a very simple, abstract example. Okay, so what does the Lutheran statement on sexuality say trust should reside in? family. Why?
Because you introduced your love.
Yeah. What else do you introduce?
Best chance of interaction.
Yeah. Continuous interaction.
How does the prisoner's dilemma change when you love the other one deeply?
Right. Now, that's a violation of the game. Why? No, no. This is a very, very serious point. Okay. In the way I described this problem to you, I gave you all the information to solve the game by how many years they were going to go to jail. But if I said, Rich loves Marcia, then the years going to jail wouldn't matter. There would be a totally different set of payoffs, and we'd have to have another game. Right?
Well,
you can see.
Isn't that just being set up with the family identity of a gang or the mafia or whatever? And they try to create this community, this sense of a higher, you know, sense of sacrifice. Take the hit for your brother. And then it kind of confounds that kind of proposition.
You're absolutely right. So we want to change the game, right? Game theory is arbitrary. The numbers in the box are arbitrary. So we say, but if you love each other, that's a different game. Or if you have a repeated relationship, it's a different game. And in fact, we can think about why people who can actually have strong emotional bonds to one another would behave differently in the game than people who are really strangers, because of their expectation about what would happen in the future, or their expectations, they're learning about what has happened in the past. Okay? Now, I'm not trying to teach you any more game theory, or any game theory at all, really, because I don't understand this very well. But why does this stuff about emotions and personal interaction matter here? If we talk about people who have repeated interaction, this kind of cooperation game becomes much less difficult, because we know that people that we deal with repeatedly and will deal with repeatedly in the future, we have a connection to. It may or may not be love in the parental sense or the intimacy sense, but it's a relationship that has value to us that's built by the personal interaction. How big can societies get until 10,000 years ago? 30. Remember, what kind of fact is that? Cold, hard fact. You can't say, they were really probably bigger, but we just didn't have evidence. There's a really, really good, strong reason that we don't see societies bigger than about 30 people. Now, they can get bigger and smaller, and it's clear that if you're in a band of 30 people, you want to have relationships with another band because of you don't want to interbreed. So exogamy is very common. Bands get together periodically, and women marry out or men marry out or some kind of relationship like that. So there's often tribes that share some kind of identity and relationship. Of course, when they get together, they swap spouses, and then they drink and they start killing one another. So they got to get back to your quarter. Okay, but that the ability of us to coordinate and trust other people about things that are serious, if it depends upon repeated interaction and personal knowledge, is going to limit us to very small groups. Now, we can see why, too, that this isn't... I can do this in economics. And if I was a little bit smarter, I could actually write down a proof in mathematics. Okay. I have colleagues who have done that. We're not quite done yet. But we didn't start yet. Okay. But what happens is that if we need personal interaction to trust one another, and we want to coordinate our activities, we're limited to small groups. Because we can look down the game tree. We can see the possible interactions that are going to happen, and we can see where the person who, even though we trust them, may defect, and if they're going to defect, our best option is to cheat first. So the whole thing unravels unless we have very strong personal connections. We can call it love, we can call it genetics, because we tend to trust people within our families. We can call it habit and association. There's all kinds of sociology about this, about identity and things. So, what's another possibility, though, for solving the problem that you came up with earlier?
Talking to each other.
Yeah, well, talking to each other, but you said another word. It began with a C.
Oh, contract.
Yeah, contract. It's possible for Rich and Marcia to, rather than going, before they go to jail, that Marcia's son lives at Rich's house, and Rich's son lives at Marcia's house. And they have this deal. If either one of us cheats, I kill your son. Pretty severe. Now what happens to the prisoner's dilemma problem? Well, it becomes much less a problem because the two people have committed in this relationship real valuable assets that are at risk if either one of them defects. Hostages, bonding, religion. Those of you who heard David say, if an ELCA pastor or employee is caught involving any kind of sexual misconduct, what will happen? They're gone. Bonding. Promise. Okay? Now, the ELCA does not require employees to deposit their oldest son to the church. What we see in relationships is that about 10,000 years ago, we start observing larger societies. And the nature of society changes because people have managed to solve this problem of trust in a set of circumstances that involves what we could call contracts, would be one way to say it, that is agreements between them about what happens when our relationship starts to break down. The title of this talk is Incomplete Relationships. If we only rely on relationships to structure human societies, our love for one another, our shared experience, how big is the biggest group going to be? Nothing in our genetic makeup has changed. Cold hard fact number 3. We are capable of emotional responses in relationships. And in fact, most of our life is not structured by contract. It's structured by relationships. The ability, however, to promise, to pre-commit in a contract, was just through a bonding, through a hostage, through posting some valuable asset that's at risk if you defect, enables relationships to become more durable. That can potentially enable societies to get larger. When societies get larger, do our feelings about trust change? No, we still trust, right? I don't know if you, I wish I had David on the screen here. The sexuality statement says that people who are not, I mean, people are made by God to trust. Unless they are damaged, all children will trust. Did you, anyone hear that yesterday? Mm-hmm. Yes and no. God created all of us with an inherent ability to trust, with an inherent ability to connect emotionally with other people. And for most of human history, we learned to trust 30. And what about everybody else? Shoot first, ask questions later is a rational response to somebody you don't know and might fear. How do we build trust? The statement on human sexuality talks about trust within the family as being the most important problem to solve in the problem of human sexuality. How do we get stable families? How do we create situations in which the emotional learning that takes place is conditioned by long-term healthy emotional relationships? That's absolutely right. But what scale of society does that support? 30. That's how we're wired. So I don't want to drop any of the emotional stuff. I don't want to go away from that. I want us to hold and cherish all that. And tomorrow, we're going to talk about how you actually get bigger. And there, the main problem is going to be, how do we guard against violence? All right? See ya.